We're spending the hour on pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show with specific interest in women's access to and control of money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new Women in the Workplace report found that 1 in 4 women are considering scaling back their career or leaving the workplace altogether. Mothers in particular bear the heaviest burden. Here's Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook on NPR this month.
What we are seeing in this report should terrify all of us. We are pulling the alarm bell here.
How are you juggling work and family amid COVID? How is it affecting your family's financial stability? Has the pandemic caused your family to make a drastic change? Tell us about the dynamics. What's going on? Bring your financial questions. 800-642-1234. Kara Perez is a financial coach and founder of the financial resource site Bravely Go. Kara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the millennial generation. And just for disclosure, you're a millennial and you write about how economic events have had an impact on your generation. Can you explain what's going on?
Absolutely. So economic events certainly impact every generation, but millennials are sort of uniquely situated. We are dealing with our second, quote, once-in-a-lifetime economic crisis within a decade, and that has had a major impact on our finances. Everything from being able to pay off student loan, which millennials disproportionately carry, to earning more money in the workplace. Work has changed drastically in the last decade. We've moved from a system where we could expect certain retirement benefits to a gig economy in a large part, which does not come with a lot of workplace benefits, which means it's harder for millennials to do things like save and invest. So I don't want to say that only millennials are dealing with this, but it's been a rough road for us.
And so when you have that situation, two once-in-a-lifetime recessions, how has the Great Recession and the conditions now changed how millennials approach finances? What's different?
I think for a lot of people in my generation, the difference is largely in the relationship to money. There's been a million articles written about how millennials will spend on experiences rather than things. And that's very true. I feel that myself. I know that's a priority for most of the people in my age group because experiences cannot be taken from us. Where it does feel like items or even holding on to money in the bank is kind of pointless because it does feel like, well, that will have to go to debt or I'll never be able to afford a home. So I think the approach to money is different. And I also think the actual earning power, we know that, for example, a new report just came out, millennials represent about 38% of the workforce, but only control about 4.6% of the wealth in the United States. So disproportionately, we don't have that much money in our hands.
Yeah, and the net worth of millennials has decreased by 34% since 1996. That's a Deloitte study recently. I'm wondering what long-term effect, what is the ripple effect here? Do you anticipate that this financial situation will have on this generation?
My number one concern is retirement savings and investments. If you don't have access to a workplace retirement plan, it's much harder to begin investing. And the longer you wait to invest, the less time your money has to compound in the market, meaning ultimately you have less money when you do decide to step away from work. So we often hear we have a current retirement crisis, which is also true, but I'm very concerned that in 20, 30 years, when millennials begin to step away from the workforce, a lot of them will be retiring into poverty.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kara Perez. She's a financial coach and founder of the financial resource site Bravely Go. You can join in. Have you struggled to create or stick to a budget? What have you learned or adjusted to in the current financial situation? Are you a millennial? Have you been here before? And what financial situations are you grappling with now? Join in with your situation, your questions about money, 800-642-1234. Kara, your site Bravely Go offers money tips and financial coaching. How do you advise people to approach budgeting?
I always tell people to pursue what's called values-based budgeting. And so rather than me as the financial pro saying, here's how I spend my money, you should try your best to mimic this, what values-based budgeting tells us is identify your true values. So that's not, you know, cheese is not a value, but we love it. And I know this is Wisconsin, but cheese itself is not so much the value, but it might be, I value spending time with friends and family. Those are the most important people in my life. And I want to do that over wine and cheese. So the value is time with loved ones, but the expression is eating out. It's important to identify that value so that we can know, okay, instead of going out to eat three times a week to see the people I love, which is wreaking havoc on my budget, I can go for a walk with the people I love. We can do movie night in. I guess I'm not encouraging non-social distancing here, but it's values-based budgeting is set in this idea of, if I can identify the things I deeply care about, I can stop spending on things that I don't care as much about. And that allows everyone to craft a unique budget that will work for them.
It sounds like I'm also hearing here that relationships are priceless and that you can build relationships without having to put money into that.
Absolutely. I come from a low income background. In my early 20s, I made well under $20,000 a year for several years working as a waitress. And I had moved to a new city and I needed friends. And one of the best ways I did that was reaching out to people on Facebook or on Instagram and saying, hey, I'd love to go for a walk. Hey, I'd love to go to this, free art show. Would you be interested in that? So friendship, family relationships don't necessarily have to impact our wallet from a spending point of view.
You know, a budget is also only as good as your ability to stick with it. How can we hold ourselves accountable when budgeting?
Yeah, and this is another reason I love values-based budgeting, because the more that we relate to our budget and the more that we see clearly what our budget is doing for us in terms of moving us closer to our goals, both financial and personal, the more likely we are to stick to it. So finding the right tool, the right budget style that works for you is a form of accountability. But beyond that, I am a big, big fan of scheduling. So budgeting is something that people should be doing ideally each week, and setting aside a time so that you know, okay, 7 p.m. on Tuesday nights, I do 30 minutes on my budget and I have a glass of wine or I have some sparkling water. Make it fun. Put on your favorite music. Have your favorite dinner that night. You know, budgeting should be something you look forward to. There should be some sort of small reward in it rather than something you dread. It doesn't have to be like doing your seventh grade math homework.
But really kind of setting a date and keeping that date to check in with how you're doing.
Yes, exactly. Set a calendar reminder. If you have a partner or a friend that you can do it with at the same time, you know, you can hop on Zoom calls and say, okay, we're going to spend 30 minutes reviewing our spending. There's that accountability buddy. So now you've said it out loud. You've got that worked in. And like I said, I think it's also wise and smart and fun to build in small rewards for yourself. So if you hit your savings goal every week for a month, you know, at the end of that month, go ahead and give yourself a little treat. I'm not saying blow $500, but I'm saying, you know, spend $5 to $10 on something that matters to you.
Kara Perez runs a feminist financial education company called Bravely Go. She's our guide to money matters this hour. Have you been laid off or furloughed, or are you preparing for that day to come? What questions do you have about cash flow, about budgeting? Are you investing now or putting money into an emergency fund? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kara Perez here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on money issues here on The Morning Show, specifically challenges women are facing financially. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So back in the first part of the year before the pandemic struck, women in Wisconsin experienced slightly less joblessness than men. And then everything was turned on its head in April. The unemployment rate for Wisconsin women spiked to 18%. Women experienced higher levels of unemployment for four straight months after that. And a law professor told WPR this week it's erased 40 years of progress for working mothers. How is the pandemic affecting your money decisions and how you take care of your family? Have you been forced out of the workforce? How are you handling the change with your money? We're at 800-642-1234. We have financial educator and founder of Bravely Go, Kara Perez, as our guide. So, Kara, let's look at women in the workforce. Some of your advice is very specific to women. How are women in a different economic financial position?
Well, even before COVID, we knew women were in a different economic position because we know that we live in a biased world and women are paid less. Women of every race are paid less. And we know that disproportionately, women are in industries that pay hourly as opposed to having salaries. Women also, there's some data out there about the access that women have to benefits like healthcare, like retirement accounts, like paid time off. So we had kind of a broken system before COVID came, and then COVID kind of dropped a hammer and exacerbated all of these existing issues. So what we're really seeing now, to what you just said, is that women are being set decades back. Women are leaving the workforce at higher rates than men right now to stay home, to care for children. And in one way, it makes sense for many families because women are typically the lower earner in heteronormative relationships. But unfortunately, what that's doing is taking women out of work and putting up a barrier to women getting back into work in a post-COVID world.
So in this situation, what do you advise women do? I mean, how should they be approaching this situation and their money?
Unfortunately, there really are no easy answers. There's no one-two punch to this. What I really do suggest is before anyone leaves the workforce is to sit down and have a very real conversation with yourself and with your partner or your family about what leaving the workforce means for your personal finances as a woman, for the household finances, and what the loss of your income and the loss of this professional track that you're on might mean for your return to work. Are you in an industry that is in high demand or that post-COVID will bounce back? Are you in an industry that is undergoing major shifts and you're not totally sure what the post-COVID landscape will look like? How easy do you think it will be to get back into work should you step away? And these are questions that might be difficult to predict, but that are very well worth asking before you step out of something.
We're talking with Kara Perez, who's a financial coach and founder of the blog and financial resource site Bravely Go. She's fielding your financial questions this hour. Do you have trouble understanding your partner or your children's spending habits? What do you want to know about managing money in these difficult times? Are you leaving the workforce? What is that like for you financially? We're at 800-642-1234. Kara, you know, one of your missions is to really make financial tools, financial education very much open to everyone and not just the wealthy. How are you doing that? And how do you approach money with women as opposed to other groups?
I think that the more accessible something is, the more accessible something is, right? So a big concern for me in the financial industry is, who is doing the financial educating in our world? What do they look like? What language are they using? And historically, and still today, finance is a world very dominated by white men, which is, you know, no shade to white men, but it does not necessarily, if you are a brown woman, you're not necessarily going to see yourself reflected in the world of what we call high finance. That would be like Wall Street finance. So a big thing for me is to come at it and to share my personal experiences, what it was like when I was working as a waitress, what I did to pay off my own student loan debt as a millennial, and to use language as well as analogies and stories that people can connect with. It's very difficult for most people to hear from a high income heteronormative couple about how they simply traded in their Lamborghini for a more sensible Subaru, but it's much easier for someone to say, okay, so I've been driving, I have been driving my 2009 Kia Rio for over a decade. Let me tell you how I keep it in good shape so that I don't have to buy a new car. So I try to come at it from a point of openness and accessibility.
What did you do to pay off your debt?
Great question. So I paid off, I graduated with a little over 25 grand in student loans and a degree in critical race theory in English. So I'm happy to chat about that anytime. But I was very low income for the first few years out of school. And so really, it wasn't so much about reallocating my dollars as it was about trying to increase my dollars. It's very hard to make headway on debt when you only make $18,000 a year. So first and foremost, I started focusing on increasing my income. And then secondly, I cut back on literally any extraneous expense. If it wasn't health insurance, actually I didn't have health insurance for a full year while I was paying off my debt. But if it wasn't, you know, gas to get me to work or groceries or rent, I really did not spend. And so I was an extremely frugal person for a while, which is another difficult way to live. But my debt was just small enough that I knew if I spent 6 months doing this, I could get out of it. And I paid off my last $18,000 in about 8 months, 10 months.
Wow.
I'm trying to remember.
Wow, that's very rapid. What did that do to you psychologically?
Honestly, I was 26 and I was floundering a little bit. I was definitely having my quarter life crisis. And so in some ways it did act as a touchstone for me. I knew that that was what I was doing in life. I was paying off debt. I wasn't really trying to do anything else. So it gave me clarity, but it was needlessly hard. It shouldn't have to be that hard. We live in the richest country in the world, and we have the resources to change the way that we do things and the way that we treat our citizens. And I think that the system should be different. The system should be looking to help citizens more so than it currently does.
When you look at the tools out there to help women, to help people who are not well off, get a leg up and try to put their money to work, what are some of the best tools out there for that?
That's a great question. I think the most powerful tool that some people have at their disposal is that workplace retirement plan. So that's your 401k or your SEP IRA or whatever it is. Definitely, definitely take your workplace up on that, especially if there is a match. That's something that I've never had access to and I've always been jealous of. Outside of that, I love an IRA, which stands for Individual Retirement Account. And I'm really beating the drum for women on retirement because women live longer and we earn less and we tend to start investing later in life, which all adds up to meaning we have less money later in life. So in our 60s and 70s, women are 80% more likely than men to retire into poverty. So the earlier you can get into planning and investing for your retirement, the better off you will be and the better off your family will be in large part. So I would say that's number one. But I think the second biggest thing is really getting in touch with your everyday spending and understanding where your dollars are going, and do that without judgment. A lot of people in personal finance will say, how dare you buy that coffee? Or I can't believe you treated yourself. But treats are nice. I understand that. But what's important is that we have a plan for the treats just as much as we have a plan for retirement.
But also trying not to be overbearing, I wonder, can you be spontaneous in that type of rigid, disciplined budgeting world?
You absolutely can. Perhaps not in the beginning. You know, just like learning anything else, practice makes perfect. And practice in the world of budgeting does equal flexibility. In the beginning, when you're really trying to figure out, okay, where's my money coming from? Where's it going? And you're beginning to do things like maybe call your internet provider, see if you can negotiate a lower rate, or call your credit card company and see if they'll remove that late fee charge. All of a sudden, if you can get those things done consistently and you can lower your overall costs, you've freed up $50, $100 a month. And that's where your flexibility will begin to come in. And that's when you can spontaneously say, you know, let's go out to dinner tonight and not have to worry about how you're going to pay for that or if that will push you over budget.
We are tackling money and equity issues in personal finance this hour with financial coach Kara Perez at our side. Are you a financial planner? What are you telling your clients now, especially if they're newly unemployed? What problems do you often see families making in a money crisis? What suggestions can you share about leaving the workforce to care for your children? How are you making it work financially now? Join in with your financial questions, your situation, front and center, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Kara Perez right after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about pandemic money issues, specifically the challenges women are up against. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Of the 1.1 million workers over the age of 20 who left the labor force last month, an alarming 80%, 4 out of 5 were women. That's the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics monthly jobs report with analysis by the National Women's Law Center. And there's fear that this could greatly jeopardize a woman's financial independence for decades to come. Have you seen financial setbacks due to the pandemic and recession? What type of support or guidance are you seeking out? Have you made financial changes, big or small, since March? How are they working out as we approach the end of the year? We're at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. Kara Perez is a financial coach and founder of the financial resource site Bravely Go, and she's our guide. So, Kara, I want to dig into financial fear. What is financial fear?
Ooh, another great question. Financial fear can be fear about your life, your security, your day-to-day stability caused by your financial situation, or it can be fear of looking at your financial situation, you know, anxiety and dread when you have to log into your bank account or your credit card.
So how do you approach this paralysis? How do you advise people when they have this type of fear?
This type of fear is very common. So money is the number two reason for divorce in the United States, and about 60% of Americans cite financial anxiety as their largest source of anxiety. So this is something that a lot of us are dealing with, which I think really democratizes it. You're not alone if you feel this way. And we don't really talk about money in the United States, especially in polite company, and I'm using that sarcastically. But I think it's so important when we're talking about fear specifically, or anxiety or shame, to say, actually, I'm going to step out of this by talking to other people about this. So that might be your close friend, it might be a coworker, it might be your mom, but just to open the door very broadly and say something like, hey, do you ever think about money? Or, hey, do you budget? I was thinking about starting a budget, but I don't really know where to start, and I'm a little freaked out by it. Do you have any advice? Do you do that? So that opens the door for you to have this type of emotional support from someone you love and care about. I also think it's well worth it to sit down and sit with the fear and to really examine where it's coming from for you. Is it a fear of not having enough? Is it a fear of making the wrong decision? Is it a fear of wanting to move on from a job or something, but not knowing what's next? Identifying that gives you power over it and helps you identify a way to deal with it.
But it's been very socially taboo in our country to talk about money, especially talk with coworkers about what they make, what you make. What do you think of that?
I think it's a shame. And I think it's really hurting a lot of people, especially women, especially when it comes to the workplace. Since we know there is a pay gap, discussing your pay with your coworkers is actually a great way to find out if the company is discriminating against you. But unfortunately, you're right. It is strongly discouraged. Some places have an explicit policy against speaking to coworkers. And we are beginning to see that shift a little bit as more people realize, hey, this is a way to continue discrimination. But I do think it's something that we as a country really struggle with. It's really in our national kind of psyche and identity that talking about money is rude. And we need to get over that, frankly.
Is there ever like the right time to do it? Like, when is the right time to have a conversation like that, that is deeply personal, that can also make you feel kind of icky or strange?
Yeah. So remember in college when you would have the best conversations with your dorm mates and your friends at like 2 a.m.?
Yeah.
That's not what I'm suggesting for those of us that are in the workforce or parents or anything like that. But finding that same kind of vibe, that same time with your existing friends and family, that's what you're going for. When you feel safe, when you feel happy, when you know this is a person you trust. So that might be in the car, driving your mom to the doctor when you're like, you know, we're really bonded right now. Let's get into it. Or it might be saying to your friends, hey, I want you to come over, sit in my backyard, have a drink with me. And I really want to talk to you about something. But what you're looking for, it's not so much that it's like 7 p.m. on Tuesday or during the lunch break at work, that that's going to be the best. It's going to be the best when you feel safe and that you know you're going to be heard.
We're talking with Kara Perez, who's a financial coach and founder of the financial resource company Bravely Go. She's spending the hour with us and fielding your personal finance questions, talking about money and where we go from here in the pandemic. We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now, who's joining us from Columbus. Hi, Chris.
Hey, great show as usual. You know, it's coincidental. My wife and I just sat down and did a really deep dive for several hours into our finances yesterday. And it was scary, but I believe that it did bring us together and is going to help us work better as a team. And it made me think, as in your opening monologue about money and women's power, is I didn't hear you talk about marriage. And the number one predictor of poverty is single motherhood. And marriage is such a multiplier that people can work as a team and piggyback off of each other's strengths. And that should be something that is included in the money conversation.
Chris, thanks for that. Kara, what do you think there?
Chris is absolutely right. Marriage is a huge change to finances and can be a real step up for people. A combining of money, going from one income to two incomes, can be very powerful. It's also something to make sure that you have a system around. A lot of couples don't ever talk about money before they get married. And then when they do get married, they realize, oh, you have $10,000 in credit card debt. Oh, you spend in this way, I spend in that way. I'm a saver, you're a spender. So having that conversation before you sign any legal paperwork is really a good idea. I would say essential. And then figuring out what you want to do with any combined assets and how your cash flow will work as a couple to make sure that it is benefiting both of you and your new life together.
And certainly that both parties are aware of where the money is going and who's doing what. You know, certainly a lot of transparency there.
Yes. And to Chris's point, you know, he said it was a little scary. It can definitely be a little scary, even with the person you love the most, because we do harbor this. If I keep my money situation secret, nobody knows, so no one can judge me. But also on the flip side, no one can praise you. No one can celebrate you. When I first started dating my boyfriend, he had a little over $60,000 in student loan debt. And him telling me that was certainly a difficult conversation for him, especially because that was my peak debt payoff period. But every time he made a big payment over the ensuing years, I celebrated him. We were moving towards a goal together and he was moving towards a goal individually. And I think thinking of it as a way to invite someone in to know you intimately and to be your cheerleader is a way to approach that.
Let's take another call now. Charlotte is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
You know what? I was just wondering what we should do with our change. We have tons of change, and a lot of banks are closing their change, you know, I should say the thing that makes, you know, money from the change. And I was just wondering what we should do with our change. Should we just all cash our change in?
Good question, Charlotte. You know, that those coins collect, we have money jars in all of our kids' rooms. You know, Kara, what about that change?
That is a great question. I think for the time being, a lot of banks are going to keep those change counters closed because of COVID. But what this is a great opportunity to practice saving, and especially if you do have children, to literally watch it pile up. And I would say, assign that a goal. Say, you know, once COVID is over, or once we have whatever, you know, feels right for your family, we are going to do X with this. And get everybody on board, whether you have kids or it's just you and your partner, so that you can watch it pile up. This is a great opportunity to practice the art of restraint and to set a goal around your money that feels fun and that feels lower key. Lower pressure, rather than, oh, we have to have X for a down payment or something. So I would put it someplace you can see it, contribute to it as you can, put a big post-it on it that says Florida 2021, and, you know, have fun with it.
And I think, and I might be wrong on this, Charlotte, but your bank may be able to give you those paper rolls where you can count each, you know, penny, dime, quarter, nickel, you can hand count it. And then you bring those rolls into the bank and they'll take it from there. But I think the coins have to be rolled.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I would say ask the bank because they may be willing to give it. They have in the past for me, they just give you the paper rolls and you have to do it yourself. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you
You're welcome.
For the question. We appreciate it. So, Kara, you know, as we look at these little ways that we can throw change in a jar and capture all of these pennies, if you will, because they add up.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say small things become big things. So if you have had trouble saving in the past, or you're new to the idea of it, you've gotten your first job or something, start small. Try saving, you know, $5 a week, $10 a week, or 1% of your paycheck, whatever is easier for you. And you have to develop the muscle. So when we're in the gym, we don't go straight to the 300-pound bench press. We start with the 10-pound dumbbells. So that's where you are in your financial journey. That's totally fine.
Personal finance expert Kara Perez stays with us. Still time to talk about your financial situation, what you're up against. What advice can you give about how your family is managing to stay afloat in these times? How much of your earnings are you trying to set aside? And what happens if you do get furloughed or laid off? Do you have a plan? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kara Perez here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with financial coach Kara Perez. She founded the feminist financial education company Bravely Go, and we've been talking about how from job losses to career downsizing, women are taking a financial hit in this global health crisis. Let's take another call now. Daryl is with us from Germantown this morning. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to express, I feel that in this country we have goofy ideas about parenting, and one of them is the idea that it's not a good idea to talk to your children about finances. It's actually the best way to support them. And I did that. I expressed with my daughters that I struggled with it at one time and talked to them about that and gave them ideas of how I got out of it. And that's a way to support them as a parent.
So you were very open with your own financial struggles. And what did your children say?
Well, they appreciated it because they were in that, they're in that position they were, and they're working through it. And I think it's a wonderful way to connect with your children.
Daryl, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Kara, you know, how should we approach money talks with kids?
I completely echo Daryl's sentiment that we have goofy ideas about parenting in this country. And I love that he spoke with his kids. So important to have this conversation. Really, as soon as you think your kids can, you don't have to sit down your six-year-old and say, here's how the stock market works. But I think a great time is when your child wants something so that you can begin to explain the relationship between money and spending and getting things that you want. A great time to do this is in the grocery store. You know, kids, especially younger kids, might see a cereal they want. Mommy, can we get this? Daddy, can we get this? And you can use that as an opportunity to explain how a budget works or something like that. As your kids get older and their needs or their wants become a little bit more complex, maybe you do want to speak to your 15-year-old about how the stock market works and when they want to begin investing. That is such a gift to give to your child. It's something that growing up, we never really talked about money, and not only for the practical knowledge, but for the emotional relationship. If we really are serious about changing this culture of not talking about money, of money being seen as rude, or I didn't know anything about money until my 30s, it does start with us teaching the next generation what we know now.
Mm, yeah. Well, this is our favorite last question that we've come to. You know, there is a sea of financial advice out there. What is your best tip for us?
This is my number one most practical tip. Open different savings accounts for different money goals. So if you are saving for a house, you're saving for a post-COVID trip, and you want to have your kind of regular emergency fund, that's three different savings accounts. And you can nickname your savings account so it doesn't just say account 297554, it'll say Florida 2021, so you know exactly what you're saving for, and then that Florida money won't accidentally get spent on the new house.
Kara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
Kara Perez is a financial coach, and she's founder of the blog and the financial resource company called Bravely Go. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about language.
The United States is a nation of immigrants, and the pressure to assimilate can be great. Some people are compelled to speak English and leave other languages behind. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look back at his own family's relationship with language.
Those traitorous Scandinavian languages. Don't be suspected. My grandparents spoke a mix of Norwegian and Swedish, or Svorsk, as it was known. They used it mostly when they wanted an unintelligible language to keep secrets from the grandkids. How I wish they'd passed on this language to me! Being second-generation Scandinavians, they wanted to keep their distance from their immigrant parents, and their thick accents, and their old-world ways. I used to believe this. I thought that the old language fell into disuse, and immigrants wanted to learn English. This perpetuated half-truth doesn't tell the tale of government agents spying on Scandinavian and German meetings looking for socialists or anti-war activists. Settlers spoke English as a matter of self-preservation, and any dissension was deemed unpatriotic. My grandfather told me he could only speak Norwegian when he entered kindergarten, and then would get in trouble since he didn't know English. How could he? I begged my grandfather to teach me Norwegian. But he warned me, we're in America. We speak English. It's better that way. Clearly, he was scared of something I didn't understand. Then I discovered that some state governments set up a Commission of Public Safety during World War I. Its purpose, to root out those deemed untrustworthy. It was mostly Germans and Scandinavians by default, those with mixed loyalty who could be considered traitors. These commissions employed virtually dictatorial powers to distribute pro-war propaganda and to restrict activities it considered hostile. These government agents infiltrated meetings and rallies to make lists of radicals and slackers, as well as just plain foreigners who lacked enthusiasm to go to war. Because it was wartime, those who questioned could be locked up indefinitely. These commissions posted notices that read, "Don't be suspected. Use American language. America is our home." This is why my grandfather was afraid, but apparently the story was not unique. A young Swedish boy in Ashland, Wisconsin, during World War I said, "We never speak Swedish on the street. Olaf was roughed up by some of the Yankee boys in a restaurant last week." Because Scandinavian languages are somewhat similar to German, anyone caught speaking them was viewed as having foreign sympathies and possibly a spy for Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, it didn't help that the pro-Hitler German-American Bund set up Camp Hindenburg in Grafton, Wisconsin in the 1930s to help young German kids become good Nazis. Up until the World Wars, immigrants often had little incentive to learn English, since most daily business transactions happened in their native language. Jim Jensen, a TV newscaster from Kenosha, said, "If you went to the Danish Brotherhood, you spoke Danish. At church, the services, the sermon, my confirmation ceremony, all in Danish." Churches and social organizations tried to retain their language, although they were on the lookout for infiltrators. Many would begin conversations in English and then slip into their native tongue once they felt safe. Many churches switched services to English to show loyalty to the U.S., but mostly to avoid suspicion. One Lutheran parishioner joked, "I have nothing against the English language. I use it myself every day. But if we don't teach our children Norwegian, what will they do when they get to heaven?"
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans this morning. This morning, the Senate Judiciary Committee will resume hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, and senators are scheduled to conclude their questioning of the nominee, Judge Barrett, today. You can hear live NPR coverage of the hearings this morning. It's starting at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio's NPR News and Music Network. And you can hear it at WPR.org. And that's starting at 8 o'clock this morning. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thank you.